Hello, friends. This is Professor Pat Kane at Santa Clara Law, and I'm here to bring you summaries of the most recent tort and personal injury cases that may be of interest to the general practitioner. I'm happy to report we are now back on schedule. I often include employment cases and insurance cases that are of interest. This month, we have a couple of employment cases, and we have an insurance issue that I will discuss in the subsequent history track at the end of the recording. In fact, let me alert you to what is contained in this month's subsequent history track in case you're someone who tunes out at that point in the session. I cover three cases on that track, three cases that I have not discussed earlier because they were not reported California appellate decisions. But one case, Viking River Cruises, is currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court and was recently argued, so I thought it should be on your radar screen if it is not already. It involves the continued validity of the Iskanian rule under which PAGA claims cannot be waived in arbitration agreements. So it should be of interest to anyone who represents employees with such claims, or others with such claims, but they typically arise in employment cases. And I include two cases in which the Ninth Circuit has presented a certified question to the California Supreme Court. One case involves insurance coverage for invasion of privacy, and the other one concerns the reach of the economic loss doctrine when a tort claim is made by someone who is a party to a contract with the defendant. Both are issues that should be of interest to Fin subscribers, so I thought they also should be on your radar screen. For any of you who are unfamiliar with Fins on Torts, stay tuned into this introduction and I'll provide you a little background. I also give you a bit of an overview of how I handle this project. If you don't need that information, then hit the forward button and move on to the first case. Here's the history. Professor Stephen Fin started this series on tort law in 1992, calling it Advanced Tapes. The name was based on the fact that he reported cases from reading them in the advance sheets. Of course, today, nothing much in print is very much in advance, since everything is almost instantaneously available online. I took over Steve's reporting upon his untimely death in 2009, and I've been working with Pincus Professional Education since that time to keep this series going. When I first started working on this project, I based my reporting on cases as I read them in the soft-bound California reporters that West is willing to provide law professors for free. I skimmed those volumes regularly to stay up on California law for academic purposes. I also teach federal taxation, so I had to skim tax notes pretty regularly as well. In law, it's important to keep current, and that's getting to be more and more difficult. Today, I read tax notes online, no longer provided free to law professors, and I read current California cases by consulting the California Supreme Court webpage. That is free, and it's a great resource. I also read their summaries of weekly decisions on the granting of review, and I periodically review their list of pending civil issues in the event I may have missed something. Sometimes that's how I pick up the certified questions from the Ninth Circuit. Now, how this works. In the past, many subscribers listened to these recordings while driving to or from work. I don't know about you, but I haven't driven to or from work since March 2020. I've been teaching remotely, and many lawyers I know have continued to work remotely. So you've lost that opportunity to drive and listen to Fins. But for those of you who do drive and listen, I know you can't stop in traffic to write down citations, so on the orange insert with each issue, I've included not only the citation to the case being discussed, but also citations to the statutes and cases that are relevant to the analysis in that case. This case list is also available on the website. There are two websites you can go to, www.advancedcollege.org, or go to the main website, which is pincusproed.com. And just hit the Fins button at the top of the menu page. If in the case list you see a reference to F/T with a date, that means that case was discussed in the Fins case summary series for the date indicated. Also, so that you don't have to remember the exact case name when I give it to you in the summary, I give each case a nickname. That way, when you look at the orange insert or the case list online, you can more easily find any case that you thought was interesting and that you might want to know more about. Because the status of cases can change, at the end of each month's recording, I will let you know if any of the current cases or prior cases have experienced a change in status. For example, the California Supreme Court may have granted review in a case. It's still citable as authority, but it's less authority once the California Supreme Court has granted review. This track at the end is called Subsequent History. You can take MCLE self-study credit for listening to these recordings, even if you're not a subscriber. So can any lawyer you wish to share this recording with. Each session is worth 1 hour of MCLE credit. And now, Pincus has arranged a method to give you participatory credit. At some point in each recording, I will provide you with a verification number, twice in each session. If you record these and send them to info@pincusproed.com, you will get a certificate to show satisfaction of participatory CLE credit. If you're hearing this series for the first time and want to become a subscriber, send us an email at info@pincusproed.com or sign up on our pincusproed.com website under the Fins tab. But for now, just settle back and listen to these most recent California cases that focus on torts and personal injury law. We'll start with a case from the California Supreme Court. The case is Sheen against Wells Fargo Bank. I discussed this case in the August 2019 issue of Fins on Torts when it was decided by the Court of Appeal. The decision in that case cemented a split among the appellate courts, and so I predicted at the time that the Supreme Court would grant review to clear up that split. That's what it has done. I called the case then the mortgagee duty case, and that's what I'll call it here as well. Basically, this is a story of yet another borrower who ran into financial trouble and ended up with a surprise, to him at least, foreclosure. As he tells the story, it goes something like this. Plaintiff purchased the home, incurring a purchase money mortgage, which is not at issue in this case. He then took out two subsequent loans, initially with Wells Fargo, who later transferred the loans, or at least the servicing of the loans, to other financial institutions. So these were basically HELOC, or home equity, lines of credit. The plaintiff then suffered financial difficulties around 2008, at the time of the first financial meltdown. He worked diligently, I'd say that because I think we're in the midst of another one, he worked diligently to request loan modifications to help him keep his residence. He had countless conversations and mailed correspondence with the various financial institutions. Ultimately, he filed for bankruptcy. But then, one financial institution reported to him that one of the mortgages was no longer considered to be in bankruptcy, and another told him, after initially rebuffing him, that it would now consider his loan modification request rather than foreclosure. And so, he sought dismissal of his bankruptcy case. 5 days after dismissal, he got a call telling him that his home was in foreclosure and would be sold that very day in a foreclosure sale. That was a surprise to him, of course. Although he had some correspondence from the financial institutions, it should have put him on notice. That correspondence did tell him the loans were in default and that he was expected to make payment in full, but in point of fact, they did not clearly threaten foreclosure. In any event, he was unable to stop the foreclosure process and so instead filed this lawsuit against Wells and other financial institutions. His primary claims were tort claims based on alleged negligent mortgage modification. Defendant demurred and the trial court sustained the demur, ruling that the mortgage bank had no duty to modify or even to attempt to do so responsibly. The parties were in contract with each other. Claims were limited to breach of contract claims, or perhaps restitution if the facts so warranted, but generally, when parties are in contract with each other, there is no tort claim for a negligent breach. This rule is consistent with economic loss rule, no tort remedy for purely economic loss in the absence of property damage or personal injury. And I will discuss this briefly in the subsequent history track because that is one of the certified questions going to the California Supreme Court. The Court of Appeal in this case agreed that recent appellate decisions regarding mortgages and foreclosures had broken from this established rule and authorized a tort claim when the mortgagee was negligent in dealing with a mortgagor over payment or modification of the loan. The Court of Appeal identified this as the new rule. But there were more cases that had historically applied the old rule, no duty. And the Court of Appeal sided with the old rule, refusing to apply the new one. The Supreme Court granted review to clear up this conflict between the old rule and the new rule, and the Supreme Court clearly declared that the old rule was still the law. But the court made it clear that the ruling was limited to the facts of this case. The issue in this case was about negligent acts in the process of securing or attempting to secure a loan modification. Therefore, the holding is that when a borrower requests a loan modification, a lender owes no tort duty, sounding in general negligence principles, to process, review, and respond carefully and completely to the borrower's application. At the same time, the court, especially Justice Liu in concurrence, recognize the number of issues that have been arising for borrowers because of negligent behavior by banks in the loan modification process. A strong plea for legislative action was made. But for now, the mortgagee duties cases holding, affirming the decision below, is the applicable law. There is no tort duty for a mortgagee bank to process a request for loan modification in a responsible manner. And to the extent that earlier appellate decisions seem to create such a duty, those cases are specifically disapproved. I include a list of the disapproved cases in the case list. This next case is a hard one. Well, or at least it seemed that way to me. The case is Cleveland against Taft Union High School District. It involved a school shooting, so I'll call it the school shooting case. At least since Columbine, we have struggled with this issue. Why does it happen and how can we prevent it? And as this case shows, what is the responsibility of the school in preventing such things from happening? This case, which got a fair amount of press at the time, involved the shooting of a single student. He was shot in the stomach with a shotgun and suffered grievous injury. The shooter, a classmate who certainly appears unstable, was sentenced to 27 years and will be eligible for parole in 10, at least as I read the history of the criminal proceeding. But here, the civil issue is whether or not the school officials can be held liable under a negligence theory for allowing this incident to occur. Or, more narrowly, the legal issue is, even if they were negligent, are they immune under a specific statute? At trial, the jury found the school officials were negligent and through vicarious liability assigned over 50% of the responsibility to the school district. The verdict entered against the district exceeded $2 million. The defendant school district appealed to the 5th District. There is no question that school employees can be liable for negligence, including negligent supervision of students on the same basis as a private individual may be held liable. And there is no question that a school employee's negligence can be imputed to the school district under principle of vicarious liability. And there really was no question in this case as to whether or not there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find, as they did, that the school employees were negligent. So the key issue on appeal was whether or not the employees had immunity under Government Code Section 855.6. Section 855.6 provides that neither a public entity nor its employees are liable for injury caused by the failure to make a physical or mental examination or to make an adequate physical or mental examination of any person for the purpose of determining whether such person has a mental condition that would constitute a hazard to the health or safety of himself or others. So on the surface, arguably applicable in this case. The application of this immunity statute has apparently been litigated before, but according to the court, there is not yet any published opinion on the issue. For that reason, the court elected to publish that part of its opinion, while it did not elect to publish the entire opinion. The other crucial issue was causation, which the court did find was met. But focusing on the immunity question, let me first give you some background about the facts so you can understand exactly what the employees did wrong. The shooter was a kid who claims he was constantly harassed, and that does seem to be true. Some of this was reported to his parent, his mom, and the school explained what they were doing to take care of the situation. At the time, the same time, the shooter was a kid who was constantly threatening to harm others. He often talked about wanting to shoot the kids who bullied him, maybe shoot everyone. Students who were concerned about this reported the incidents to the principal. The principal always assured them that she was aware and was taking care of the situation. The school officials did take some positive steps. They saw that the shooter saw the school counselor. They verified that there were no guns in the house, at least at the time, and there weren't. But the shooter's older brother then purchased a shotgun for skeet shooting and kept it in their shared bedroom, and the school did not know about that. Apparently, the school had an operational threat assessment team, which included the principal, actually she's described as a co-principal, and several other school employees. Such a group is in place to minimize the risk of incidents like this, and so they claim that their failure to adequately assess the danger is covered under the immunity provision because that failure amounts to a failure to make a physical or mental examination or to make an adequate physical or mental examination, language which is included verbatim in the immunity statute. As the appellate court viewed this issue, it was a question of what constitutes a mental examination, because that's the only thing covered under the statute. The school argued that all actions taken by the threat assessment team were part of such an examination aimed at determining whether or not the student was a danger. That argument would basically immunize any threat assessment team, no matter how sloppily they did their job. The court thought this was an overbroad reading and would not accomplish the attention to school safety that was required by the general duty placed on school officials to keep schools safe. An examination typically means talking to the subject and making an analysis. Here, the school counselor that the shooter met with some, not often enough apparently, did engage in this sort of examination, and that examination, even if incomplete or faulty, is shielded from liability by the statute. But the team as a whole made many additional mistakes. Specifically, they failed to carry out the threat assessment collectively. That involved a failure to adequately communicate what they knew with each other. Also, they should have included the law enforcement officer assigned to the school as a core member of the team. They failed to communicate fully with Brian's parent, including failing to recommend to the parent that the child should enter counseling. Finally, the team did not continue to collectively monitor the student and reassess the safety plan. In the court's view, these acts and omissions fell outside the immunity provided for mental examinations. As a result, in the school shooting case, the Court of Appeal affirmed the court below and upheld the jury's verdict against the school district. Our next case involves some awful facts, so I will keep them brief. The plaintiff, who had the mental ability of a child, was in a home for the disabled. A handyman who worked at the home lured her from her home and sexually molested her. A staff member was a witness, in a sense, since she arrived on the scene just as the attacker was zipping up his pants and fleeing. The case is Doe against Bright Star Residential Incorporated. I'll call it the duty and foreseeability case. The plaintiff, through her parents, sued the defendant home. Defendant moved for summary judgment, claiming it had no duty because it could not foresee the potential harm. The trial court agreed and granted the motion. Plaintiff's appeal to the Second District. The Court of Appeal identified two issues in the case. The first was an evidentiary issue. A police report had been excluded from evidence because it contained too much hearsay. Apparently, that is often the case. The problem for plaintiff is that it was the contents of this police report that showed that the owner of the home, or the manager, it wasn't clear which he was, did know about the risks posed by the handyman. Numerous employees recounted questionable actions by the handyman around residents and things that were reported, those things were reported to the owners. Without this evidence, the trial court was unable to find enough evidence to show foreseeability of the risk and therefore a duty to protect against the risk. The hearsay discussion is complex, and I am not an expert in evidence, but I'll try. The reports involve instances of double hearsay, but the appellate court explained that those objections could be overcome if there was a justification at each of the two levels, and clearly they were looking for one because this was crucial evidence that was needed to bring the case successfully. The officers running the investigation, the managers who were also defendants in this case, the home and its managers, made statements indicating that they did have knowledge of the problems about the handyman. While technically those statements were hearsay as to their inclusion in the police report, because they were said to the policeman, they were statements made to a police investigator that were against interest. And that was sufficient to create the necessary justification for overcoming the hearsay objection as to the statement. At the second level of hearsay, another justification applied. The police report itself was an official record covered by hearsay exemption in Evidence Code Section 1280. So those two justifications should have overcome the double hearsay, and the police report should have been admitted. Now, there were other statements by employees that were attacked as hearsay. They reported misappropriate behavior by the handyman, but the court pointed out that these statements were not being offered for their truth or falsity, but only for the purpose of showing that the people running the home knew about the alleged problems because the employees had reported the problems to them. Once the objections to the police report are overcome and it can be admitted as evidence, the duty question becomes a much easier one. Since the home knew of the risk, of course it had a duty to protect its residents against that risk. It could be found liable for negligent hiring and negligent supervision. There were enough facts to overcome the motion for summary judgment. In the duty and foreseeability case, the Court of Appeal reversed the decision below. And here is your first verification number. It is 1955. I repeat, the number is 1955. Our next case involves an arbitration agreement signed as part of the admissions papers of a patient to a nursing home. We've seen a number of similar cases. Based on my readings of the California reports, I'd have to say that nursing homes are notoriously bad at getting the right person to sign such agreements. This case is typical. The case is Rogers against Roseville SH. I'll call it the invalid arbitration agreement case. The facts are fairly straightforward. Claude, the patient, was in his early 80s. He suffered from some dementia, but he was not incompetent at all. He was admitted to Meadow Oaks of Roseville. Meadow Oaks is the name of the facility. It's a residential care facility for the elderly. While there, he suffered multiple falls because he didn't receive adequate supervision, which would have prevented the falls. The staff were also negligent in a number of other ways. For example, often when family members came to visit, they would find Claude outside in his wheelchair unattended. But Claude could not push himself in his wheelchair, and he could not open the facility door to enter or exit the facility by himself. Family members repeatedly instructed the staff not to leave Claude outside unattended. But on June 30, 2018, Claude was left outside for hours. It was a hot day. He suffered severe heat stroke and died on July 14th, just 2 weeks later. Plaintiffs, who are the surviving members of Claude's family, sued the defendants, the owner of the facility, for elder abuse and wrongful death. Defendant moved to compel arbitration, relying on an agreement signed by Claude's son, Richard. Richard was the one who also signed the admitting papers, promising that the bills would be paid, all of that sort of stuff. Why did Richard sign the papers? because the manager of the facility asked him to. The manager asked Richard to come into the office to sign some papers. No one asked Claude to sign the papers. There was no evidence that Claude asked Richard to sign the papers for him. Richard signed the papers, indicating he was signing as a representative. He did wonder at the time why they asked him to sign the papers, because he lived some distance away and would not have been around. But he did sign them, and he also signed the appendix that contained the arbitration agreement. But there's no indication that Richard had any legal authority to act on Claude's behalf. As a result, the trial court denied the motion to compel, finding that there was no valid agency agreement between Claude and Richard, and therefore no valid arbitration agreement. It should have been signed by Claude. Richard simply did not have the authority to sign the agreement on Claude's behalf. Defendant appealed to the Third District, and the Third District affirmed, not surprising. A couple of interesting points to note in the decision, however. First of all, the defendant repeatedly referred to facts in the case with no reference to the record. The court announced that with no reference to the record, such assertions of fact were totally forfeited. So, nursing homes are not only bad at overseeing the signing of agreements, but they also seem to be bad at proving them in court. The court also made it clear that the burden of proving a valid agency agreement lies with the person who is dealing with the purported agent, here the defendant home. There was no evidence that Claude was incompetent, and there was no evidence that Claude asked Richard to sign anything. In fact, there was no evidence that Claude even knew that Richard had signed something. There was not any evidence that Richard might have held a durable power of attorney that in the right circumstance might have been used to act on behalf of Claude. Defendant argued that since Claude had the right to rescind the arbitration agreement within 30 days, his failure to do so should be viewed as a ratification of the agreement. But how could Claude ratify something that he knew nothing about? The court thought no. Defendant also argued that since Richard signed the papers as though he had the authority to do so, the court should at least find an ostensible agency. But, said the court, an ostensible agency arises when the principal's conduct causes the third party to reasonably believe that the agent has the authority to act on the principal's behalf. An agency, whether it's actual or ostensible, cannot be created by the conduct of the agent alone. Rather, conduct by the principal is essential to create the agency. Here, there was no evidence of any conduct by the principal, Claude. Finally, defendant argued that the trial court's ruling that Richard did not have the authority to sign the arbitration agreement, but had the authority to sign the other admissions documents, singled out the arbitration agreement for special treatment, and we know that would violate the Federal Arbitration Act. But the only issue before the trial court on defendant's petition to compel arbitration was whether or not a valid agreement to arbitrate existed. The trial court was not asked to and did not decide whether the other admissions documents Richard signed were valid or enforceable. The trial court applied general principles of contract and agency law to determine whether or not Richard had the authority to sign the arbitration agreement. The arbitration agreement was not singled out. It was the only agreement under consideration by the court. And so, in the invalid arbitration agreement case, the Court of Appeal affirmed the decision below. Here's another California Supreme Court case. And like our first case, it settles a conflict between different courts of appeal. The conflict involves a question of what costs of litigation can be recovered by a successful party under Code of Civil Procedure 1033.5. The case is Siegel against ASICS America Corp. I'll call it the taxing cost case. The case began when plaintiff sued defendant for fraud. The case went to the jury, and the jury ruled in favor of defendant. Defendant, as prevailing party, sought to recover costs as allowed under Section 1032, and then turned to Section 1033.5, which in subsection A lists the costs that are mandatorily recoverable. Subsection B of that section lists those costs that are not recoverable. And subsection C, at least at subparagraph 4, gives the trial court discretion to award additional costs even if they are not listed in subparagraph A. The costs at issue in this case were the costs of preparing photocopies of exhibits, exhibit binders, and closing argument demonstrative aids that were prepared but ultimately not used at trial. Plaintiff argued that these costs should not be included, and defendant, of course, opposed that position. Following a hearing, the trial court ultimately allowed defendant to recover their costs, the costs associated with photocopying trial exhibits, creating exhibit binders, and preparing demonstrative boards and slides, even though they were not, in fact, used at trial. The Court of Appeal affirmed the ruling. First, it held that costs associated with unused demonstratives and photocopies of trial exhibits are specifically recoverable under 1033.5A13. That provision authorizes the recovery of costs for, and I quote, models, the enlargement of exhibits and photocopies of exhibits, and the electronic presentation of exhibits, including costs of rental equipment and electronic formatting, if they were reasonably helpful to aid the trier of fact. I repeat that ending because that's the crucial language. If they were reasonably helpful to aid the trier of fact. Now, this holding by the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeal in this case, conflicts with rulings by other courts of appeal that have ruled the words in the statute must be construed literally, and if the exhibits were not used in the trial, there's no way they can be viewed as having, in fact, been reasonably helpful to the trier of fact. The Court of Appeal also ruled that the costs could be awarded in the discretion of the court pursuant to Section 1033.5C4. Which also imposes, subsection C also imposes general limitations as to the reasonableness of the cost. This holding, the ability to award the cost in the discretion of the trial judge, also conflicts with some rulings of other courts that have held that since the costs in question are not in fact described in A13 because they were not in fact used, there is an implicit exclusion for the cost of exhibits unless they were in fact used. The Supreme Court granted review to resolve this conflict. First, the Supreme Court agreed with those courts that found costs for exhibits not in fact used are not included in the language of subsection A13. Applying a plain meaning approach to the language of the statute, the words clearly refer to exhibits that were helpful, which means that they have to have been introduced at trial in order to actually help the trier of fact. The language does not say or even imply that it applies to exhibits that would have been useful. Were useful simply does not translate into would have been useful. But the Supreme Court did agree with the other part of the Court of Appeal ruling that the cost of the unused exhibits could be included in the discretion of the trial court. Plaintiff objected on several grounds, including the following. It would make no sense, said the plaintiff, to make the losing party pay for the cost of exhibits prepared by an overzealous opponent when the losing party had been successful in preventing the use of the exhibits on the basis of legal evidentiary grounds. But the Supreme Court thought issues like this were well covered by the statute's reasonableness requirements. There is an argument to make the trial court, this argument could perhaps be made to the trial court, but the court trusted the trial judge's exercise of discretion in making the determination as to whether or not the costs were reasonable based on all the facts in that case. And so, in the litigation cost case or the taxing cost case, the Supreme Court affirmed in part the decision below, approving of the ruling in favor of discretionary award of such cost, but reversing as to the ruling that included the costs of unused exhibits in the list of costs under subsection A13. Earlier, we had a case involving a school shooting. This case involves a shooting that took place in an employee's home. The shooter was the son of the employee who lived in the home, and as a veteran of Afghanistan, suffered from PTSD. The two plaintiffs were visiting the employee and her husband for a meal. During the meal, the son opened fire on the group. He shot and killed his stepfather, who was one of the hosts. He wounded the other three in attendance. The sole issue in this case is whether or not the employee's employer could be held either directly or vicariously liable for the shooting because the employee had been approved to work from home. The case is Colonial Van and Storage against Superior Court. I'll call it the home shooting case. Of course, the real parties in interest are the victims who were shot. At trial, defendant company moved for summary judgment, arguing it had no duty to protect the plaintiffs in the home of its employee and that it could not be vicariously liable for the harm that occurred there. The trial court denied the motion, finding that there were triable issues of fact over such things as whether or not the defendant company had any control over the premises. Defendant appealed by writ of mandate to the Fifth District Court of Appeal. The Supreme Court later transferred the appeal to the Second District. One of the plaintiffs in the case was an employee of the company, the defendant company, and the other plaintiff worked for a different company but in the same line of business. She claimed to be a business associate of the employee who was hosting the meal. The meal was part social and part business. The Court of Appeal first considered the arguments regarding direct liability. The first argument was based on premises liability, that because the injury occurred within premises that were in effect part of the defendant's business premises, the defendant company had a duty to ensure that the premises were safe. But to have a duty, the defendant must either own or control the premises, said the court. The company was clearly not the owner, and there was no evidence that the company had any control over the premises. The second argument plaintiffs made was that it was sufficient that the company derived an economic benefit from the employee's use of the home for business purposes, even if there was no evidence of control. They relied primarily on the Southland Corporation case, in which a convenience store was held liable for harm that occurred in a nearby parking lot that it did not own, but that was used by its customers, thereby benefiting the defendant store. The Court of Appeal admitted that economic benefit was a factor highlighted in that case. It was simply not, however, the only factor for imposing liability. And as subsequent cases that cite Southland have pointed out, economic benefit alone is insufficient to establish liability in a case like this. The plaintiff, who was an employee of Colonial, the defendant, argued that her employer had a duty to her because of the employer-employee relationship. But absent any evidence of the defendant company's ability to control or affect the independent behavior of the shooting son, there can be no liability simply because plaintiff is an employee. So that argument failed. Finally, as to direct liability, was there a duty? The court analyzed the Rowland factors to determine if they suggested the imposition of a duty. The most difficult factor was foreseeability, since defendant had no knowledge of the son's mental state or even that he had guns in his possession in the home, it was impossible to paint this occurrence as a foreseeable one. In fact, the only Rowland factor that clearly was met on these facts was the certainty of the harm that occurred to the plaintiffs. The court therefore ruled as a matter of law that an employer does not have a duty to protect working at home employees or their guests from third-party criminal conduct. Finally, as to respondeat superior liability, the plaintiffs would have to show that the employee of defendant was acting within the scope of her duties. Perhaps the business meal was in that scope. Perhaps if she had negligently spilled wine and destroyed the plaintiff's dress, that could be viewed as fitting within respondeat superior, my hypo, not the court's. But the son's presence had nothing to do with his mother's carrying out her duties, and clearly his shooting at everyone in the room had nothing to do with her carrying out her duties, and so the basic requisites of vicarious liability are simply not met. In the home shooting case, the Court of Appeal disagreed with the trial court and ordered it to instead grant the motion for summary judgment. The employer, who had approved working from home, could not be held liable for the unexpected criminal act that occurred at the home. Our next case is an employment law case that raises an interesting issue because it's an issue of first impression in California. The plaintiff is a medical resident. That means she was employed by defendant, that she provided services to the patients on behalf of defendant, and also was continuing her medical studies. She was terminated at the end of her second year of a 3-year residency, and she sued the employer under the FEHA, the Fair Employment and Housing Act, claiming sex discrimination and retaliation, as well as whistleblower retaliation for reporting workplace safety concerns. The main issue in the case was whether she was primarily an employee who was entitled to use the McDonnell Douglas burden shifting test under the FEHA, or was she primarily a student, in which case academic deference would come into play and might trump the McDonnell Douglas procedure. The case is Coyne against Dignity Health. I'll call it the academic deference case. This was the second trial in the case. The first resulted in a hung jury. This case went to the jury with a jury instruction on academic deference. That instruction read, since the defendant's residency program was academic in nature, defendant's academic judgment should not be overturned unless it is found to have been arbitrary and capricious, not based on academic criteria, or motivated by bad faith or ill will, or motivated by retaliation or discriminatory reasons unrelated to her academic performance. Further, you must uphold the decision of Defendant Medical Center unless you find its decision was a substantial departure from accepted academic norms as to demonstrate that the person or committee did not actually exercise professional judgment. Well, in my opinion, not a true paradigm of clarity. One thing is clear. The instruction centers attention on academic performance and requires some deference to what defendant claims the status of that performance to be. That is clearly an easier test for defendants to succeed on than proving that the reasons for the adverse judgment claimed by plaintiff were not really relevant since the defendant had a non-discriminatory reason for making the same decision. That non-discriminatory reason might be called poor academic performance, but under McDonnell Douglas, if that's their justification, plaintiff would have a chance to rebut that justification as pretextual. And under McDonnell Douglas, there's clearly no deference to what defendant says is good or bad academic performance. This academic deference standard arises in cases involving students who fail to achieve their academic goals. We don't want juries sitting as second guessers of the academic quality of a student's work, and so we give some deference to the academic institution. But we don't give that sort of deference when the academic institution is acting as an employer. Cases involving tenure denials to professors who are clearly employees are a more appropriate comparison than cases involving students, even medical students, who fail to obtain a desired degree. And this appellate court notes that analogy. Those professors proceed under Title VII if they are claiming discrimination, and they get the benefit, if you think it's a benefit, of the McDonnell Douglas framework. But at trial, the judge insisted on using the academic deference jury instruction and reasoned that a medical resident is primarily a student rather than an employee. The jury ruled in favor of defendant, and a plaintiff appealed to the Second District, complaining primarily about the jury instruction. So, is she primarily a student or is she primarily an employee? The answer to that question seems to determine whether or not academic deference is appropriate. On this question, the trial court reasoned that the residency program was primarily academic. Given that residency program guidelines require a minimum of 66% of a resident's time to be spent in patient care, the court could not rationally have based its conclusion on the amount of time residents actually spend to claim that this was primarily academic. The appellate court reasons that the trial court appears instead to have relied on the individual resident's goals in participating in this program to reach its conclusion. The trial court said, one cannot progress any further in one's career and obtain employment as a board-certified doctor unless one has complied with all of the requirements. And the requirements set forth in a nationwide standard, which requires certain subjects to be taught, graded, and the student must progress. The appellate court thought this analysis was incomplete. An equally important question asks, what were the goals of the residency program itself? Residents spend a lot of time providing services. Generally, they spend approximately 75% to 80% of their time and these services are central to the mission of the medical institution that is employing them. On an entirely different legal issue having to do with Social Security taxes, the U.S. Supreme Court in the Mayo Foundation case said these doctors who work long hours serve as highly skilled professionals and typically share some or all of the terms of employment of career employees. They are, in fact, workers, even if they are also students of their craft. In other words, the medical residents in that case were ruled to be employees and not students. This court turned then to decisions from other jurisdictions and found more support for the notion that medical residents, as opposed to students or interns, are in fact employees. Academic deference is not appropriate in a sex discrimination claim against an employer, and therefore the jury instruction was wrong. Was it prejudicial? The court went over much of the evidence in the case and found sufficient evidence of sex discrimination to support plaintiff's claim. Given the emphasis placed on academic deference, without a lot of explanation even as to what that deference meant, the instruction was clearly prejudicial. The academic complaints never seemed to be about plaintiff's knowledge, but centered on her patient care, and involved cases in which she was disciplined when male residents doing the same thing clearly were not. Personally, I found the evidence so substantial that I am mystified by the jury's verdict, even given the instruction on academic deference. And so, in the academic deference case, the Court of Appeal reversed the decision below and remanded for a new trial. This would be the third trial in this case, maybe three times a charm. And here is your second verification number. It is 3700. I repeat, 3700. Our next and final case raises a question of respondeat superior in an employment situation. A San Francisco police officer came home from an assigned training session. He had in his car a department-approved firearm that he carried with him regularly, all in accordance with police department policy. The training session did not require him to have a firearm. In fact, they were prohibited from this particular training session, so he left the gun in his car during training. When he arrived home after the training, he failed to secure the gun in his home, which was his usual practice. I mean, his usual practice was to secure it in the home, not leave it in the car. Instead, he left it unsecured in the car. That night, the car was burgled and his gun was stolen. Someone used the gun to kill plaintiff's son. She sued the city and county of San Francisco under a theory of respondeat superior. The case is Perez against city and county of San Francisco. I'll call it the scope of employment case. At trial, the defendant moved for summary judgment, claiming it could not be vicariously liable because the police officer was not acting within the scope of his employment by failing to secure his gun. The trial court agreed and granted the motion. Plaintiff appealed to the First District. The question comes down to whether or not a police officer's negligent mishandling of his department-approved firearm can be considered within his scope of employment. The department had clear rules about securing one's firearms, and officers were specifically instructed not to leave an unsecured firearm in an unattended vehicle. Why did this officer break from his normal habit of securing the firearm in his home? While the court doesn't explicitly tackle this question, there is some suggestion that the 8-hour training session, which occurred outside in the heat while the officer was in full protective gear, might have contributed to heat exhaustion, which the officer claimed he was prone to. It was a long drive home, he was suffering from heat exhaustion, he was presumably tired, and that might have contributed to his negligently leaving the gun in the car. Having a gun in his possession was clearly expected by the employer. It is a core part of a police officer's job to be prepared to deal with emergencies that might require the protection of a gun. California courts use two tests for scope of employment under the respondeat superior doctrine. Under one test, the employer is liable if the activities that caused the employee to become an instrument of danger to others were undertaken with the employer's permission and were of some benefit to the employer, or in the absence of proof of benefits, the activities constituted a customary incident of employment. Clearly, the facts in this case do not suggest the application of this test. Misuse of a gun is not, carrying a gun is beneficial, but misuse of it is not. The second test provides that an employee's conduct is within the scope of employment if, one, the act performed was either required or incident to the employee's duties, or two, the employee's misconduct could be reasonably foreseen by the employer in any event. This is the test that the appellate court thinks is applicable to the facts in this case. It is also helpful to consider the policies behind the application of respondeat superior. One policy focuses on the appropriate allocation of risk. Any losses that are fairly attributable to an enterprise, those which foreseeably could result from the conduct of the enterprise, should be allocated to the enterprise as a cost of doing business. As stated in the Farmer's case, which was cited quite a bit in this appellate opinion, a risk arises out of the employment when in the context of the particular enterprise, an employee's conduct is not so unusual or startling that it would seem unfair to include the loss resulting from it among other costs of the employee's business. In other words, where the question is one of vicarious liability, the inquiry should be whether the risk was one that may fairly be regarded as typical to the enterprise undertaken by the employer. Okay, that seems to apply in this case. An employer's tortious act under this test may be within the scope of employment, even if it contravenes an express employer rule. That happens. And even if it confers no benefit to the employer. It is the foreseeability of the act and its linkage to the core business of the enterprise that is determinative. Police and guns? Well, that linkage seems clear. And guns are dangerous, and they're sometimes negligently mishandled, and in such cases, the risk of harm to others is certainly foreseeable. The city, however, pointed to a similar case involving negligent mishandling of a police officer's gun. That case, Hendrickson against City of Rialto, was decided in 1993 by the Fourth District of Appeal. Over what seems to me a very well-reasoned dissent, the majority of that court held that such negligent mishandling was not within the scope of employment, and therefore respondeat superior did not apply. Let me give you the facts of Hendrickson. In Hendrickson, the police officer was off duty. He was socializing with some colleagues in a bar. He carried his pistol with him, as he generally did, by tucking it into his waistband, all of this in accord with department policy, which encourages policemen to keep their guns with them at all times, even when they're not on duty. When he and his friends left the bar to continue socializing elsewhere, the gun negligently went off and struck one of his companions. There is no indication that the alcohol consumption contributed to the negligent misfiring, but the majority opinion did think it changed the risk analysis. In our case, the court attempts to distinguish Hendrickson on these facts. Here, on our facts, there was no alcohol consumption, and the reasons for the gun being left in the car had a closer connection to the police officer's work than the connection in Hendrickson. He had been working, training all day, he was tired, he had to come home, and he just made a mistake. Well, that distinction seems a stretch to me. The better analysis, in my view, is that Hendrickson is just plain wrong, and our court says that as well. And so, in the scope of employment case, the Court of Appeal reversed the decision below, holding that the negligent mishandling of a firearm may be within the scope of employment for a police officer. In any event, that conclusion should not be ruled out as a matter of law. This is a narrow holding. It only addresses the issue of vicarious liability. Upon remand, there will certainly be other issues for the city to argue, especially proximate cause. The facts in this case are eerily similar to the Ninth Circuit decision I reported on in a recent issue on Fins. That was the Steinle v. United States case. That case found no proximate cause when an employee's employment-issued gun was stolen from a backpack from his locked car and subsequently involved in an accidental shooting of a third party. This is the point in the recording where I update you on any events or subsequent history that might affect any Fins cases. at least those that I've discussed in the recent past. And there's been no review granted in any recent Fins cases, except for those I have mentioned in earlier recordings. This month, however, as I alerted you to in the introduction, I want to broaden the subsequent history coverage to cover issues that are pending before the California Supreme Court that are related to issues I've covered before on Fins, even if they are arising in cases that I have not specifically discussed before. And this discussion will also include a California case that is currently pending before the United States Supreme Court, the Viking River Cruises case. There are three cases that I need to include in this segment, and I will provide citation information about all of them in the case list under the subsequent history track. Case number one, this is Moriana against Viking River Cruises. I did not report on this case because it was an unpublished CalApp opinion. That is why on the case list I can only provide the Westlaw site. But in December of 2021, the U.S. Supreme Court granted review in the case. The case was argued in March, and since that is the month I'm working on now, it caught my attention. I do expect a decision by the end of June. Well, or maybe later, if this recent link on the overruling of Roe v. Wade causes the court's work to slow down this year. The issue is the waiver of an arbitration agreement of the right to bring private attorney general act claims, known as PAGA claims, or I call them PAGA claims, the waiver of the right to bring PAGA claims in state court, is it enforceable under the Federal Arbitration Act? As we all know, under well-settled California precedent, often called the Iskanian Doctrine after the Iskanian case, California courts will not deny plaintiffs the right to bring their PAGA claims in court, even though there is an otherwise enforceable arbitration agreement that provides for a waiver of that right. The reasoning has been that an arbitration agreement is only valid if the parties to the arbitration agreement have entered into a valid agreement. A PAGA claim is a claim brought by an individual on behalf of the state government acting in the interest of the public. That makes the state an interested party in the claim, and if the state did not sign an arbitration agreement, which it certainly has not, then the arbitration agreement is unenforceable against any such claim. The waiver of PAGA claims is also viewed as a violation of public policy. The facts in the Viking River Cruises case are typical. The employee sued her employer, raising PAGA claims for certain violations of the labor code. Defendant employer moved to compel arbitration, arguing that the U.S. Supreme Court's 2018 decision in Epic Systems had effectively overruled the California Supreme Court's opinion in Iskanian. The trial court disagreed and denied the motion. Defendant appealed to the Second District. In its unreported opinion, the Court of Appeal cited to a number of California cases decided post-Epic Systems, in which the Court of Appeal consistently held that the Epic Systems decision had no impact on Iskanian. That is because Epic Systems dealt with an entirely different issue, whether or not the arbitration agreement somehow violated the National Labor Relations Act. That is different from the rights under the PAGA, which makes the state the real party in interest. The California Supreme Court denied review, and the U.S. Supreme Court granted the petition for cert. As I said, arguments in the case were completed in March. There are some predictions that, given the current makeup of the court, there are fewer justices willing to protect consumers and employees from boilerplate arbitration agreements. If so, then Iskanian could be on its last legs. I refuse to predict on the basis of oral arguments, but it does look like Iskanian may be in some trouble. I will alert you as soon as we know its fate. Now, the next two cases of interest are Ninth Circuit cases in which the Ninth Circuit has asked the California court to answer a certified question. The first of these cases is Yahoo, Inc. against National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh. The question in the case arises out of the construction of the provisions of a general commercial liability policy. The policy provides coverage for personal injury, and the definition of personal injury in the policy includes an injury that arises out of an oral or written publication, in any manner, of material that violates a person's right of privacy. According to the Ninth Circuit's according to the Ninth Circuit opinion that I read, courts nationwide are divided as to whether such a provision covers injury solely to the right of seclusion, such as where the insured's unsolicited advertising message disturbs the recipient's privacy but does not reveal private information. In this case, the complaint against Yahoo was that the plaintiff had received unsolicited advertising messages that intruded on his privacy in the sense that his seclusion was intruded upon. The solicitation was a violation of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the TCPA. Invasion of privacy also occurs when the material published is to a third person and it reveals some secret or private information about the claimant. So I'm going to refer to these as two different types of invasion of privacy. There's the invasion of privacy as invasion of secrecy. That's telling something private about me to someone else. And then there's the invasion of privacy. That's invasion of my seclusion. And that's just your unwantedly coming into my space and zapping me with advertising I don't want. There are two California appellate courts on the question of insurance coverage when the claim is an advertising injury under the TCPA. In the first case discussed by the court, the coverage language in the policy fairly clearly described only this second type of invasion of privacy, the one I call invasion of secrecy. And the injury suffered was only an evasion of the right of seclusion. So that court held no coverage. In the second case, the coverage language in the policy was closer to the facts in our Yahoo case. The language in the policy covered invasions of privacy. An invasion of seclusion is an evasion of privacy. But the court in that case construed the language in the policy to apply only to the publication of material that invaded privacy and construed that to mean publication to a third party that would make the covered harm be an invasion of secrecy, which this was not. That case, however, is 15 years old. It's been disagreed with by courts around the country, and the California Supreme Court has never spoken on this issue. And so the question presented to the California Supreme Court is whether language in an insurance policy covering advertising harms that invade someone's privacy provide coverage to an insured whose invasion is only of the claimant's seclusion and not their secrecy. The federal district court had ruled in favor of the insurance company. Now we will have to wait for the California Supreme Court to learn the correct California rule. And now finally, the second case from the Ninth Circuit is Radigan against Uber Technologies. In this case, the plaintiff is a lawyer in Argentina, and he became involved in a proposed launch of Uber's ride-sharing platform in Argentina. The entire story is complicated, but suffice it to say, the plaintiff got into severe legal trouble in Argentina, and he suffered reputational and other harms, allegedly because Uber launched its program earlier than planned without letting him know, and there were certain legal actions he was supposed to have taken before it was launched. He sued Uber on various theories, but the only claim surviving on this appeal is a claim for fraudulent concealment. The issue in the case is whether or not the economic loss rule bars his tort claim. As you know, a party to a contract is generally limited to contract damages, and generally that is measured in economic loss due to loss of the benefit of the bargain, or as some would say, unmet expectations. But here, the claim is for additional harms caused by Uber. Harms beyond the benefit of the bargain. Harms that would be recoverable under a tort theory of recovery. But the economic loss rule gets in the way and generally prevents such recoveries. If the only loss is an economic loss beyond the contract loss, then there is no recovery unless there is an independent tort committed. And what counts as an independent tort is a matter treated differently throughout the country. In California, the Supreme Court has spoken once on this issue. In the Robinson helicopter case decided in 2004. In that case, the tort involved in the contract case was fraudulent misrepresentation. That requires an affirmative act by the defendant. Silence or concealment is not that type of affirmative act. The Supreme Court ruled that fraudulent misrepresentation was a valid claim despite the economic loss rule, but it specifically withheld saying anything about fraudulent concealment, recognizing that would be a different case. And so now the time has come. The question certified to the California Supreme Court is, under California law, are claims for fraudulent concealment exempted from the economic loss rule? And that's the end of my subsequent history and update on pending issues. Well, that's it. You are now up to date on California tort law through March 2022. Don't forget to go to sister company Pincus Professional Education at pincusproed.com for our latest live and recorded litigation and appellate skill seminars. You can always use your 10% off FINS subscriber rate. Also, don't forget to send your verification numbers for this session to info@pincusproed.com to receive confirmation for participatory credit from the State Bar. So long for now, and stay tuned to keep updated with FINS on tort law.
The Dutch in old Amsterdam do it, not to mention the FINS. All those crazy folks in Siam.